welcome to Energy Law Roundup, your comprehensive weekly briefing on legal news and developments in the energy industry from Texas and across the country, always in 30 minutes or less. And now, your host for Energy Law Roundup, business litigator and oil and gas trial lawyer, Tom Charlone.
It is the week of April 3rd, 2017. Again, my name is Tom Charlone. I'm a litigation partner at Cain Russell, Coleman & Logan, resident in our firm's Houston, Texas office. It has been a good news, bad news kind of week for fracking. First, the bad news. In Maryland, last week state legislators passed a bill that would indefinitely prohibit fracking across the state. And this week, as expected, Governor Larry Hogan signed the bill into law. The new statute supplants a two-year moratorium on fracking in Maryland that expires later this year on October 1st. While New York State has also put the kibosh on fracking, there, this was accomplished by executive order of Governor Andrew Cuomo. By contrast, the Maryland ban is the first of its kind in the nation in the sense that it consists of an across-the-board legislative ban. Unfortunately, this could be a taste of what's to come in other jurisdictions. For example, earlier this year in January, Florida legislators introduced a bill that would similarly outlaw fracking in the Sunshine State. Now for the good news out of the state of Pennsylvania. There, a magistrate judge in federal court granted a large swath of the relief sought by Pennsylvania General Energy Company in its attack on a municipal ordinance promulgated by Grant Township that prohibits corporations from disposing of waste from oil and gas operations within the city. The primary basis for the judge's decision was that the ordinance applied only to corporations and to governments to the exclusion of individuals. The court reasoned that it makes, quote, no constitutional sense to slap the wrists of companies while simultaneously letting individuals engage in the same activity. This represents a blatant violation of the 14th Amendment's Privileges and Immunities Clause. Additionally, the ordinance ran afoul of the First Amendment because it purported to limit the access of corporations seeking to challenge the ordinance to, quote, community meetings, to the exclusion of the courts. Put another way, in the words of the court, the ordinance, quote, shuts down the courthouse door, which it cannot constitutionally do. Moving now to my home state of Texas, the Supreme Court here has denied review in two related closely watched cases, Endeavor Energy Resources v. Discovery Operating and XOG Operating v. Chesapeake Exploration, both pending in the Supreme Court of Texas. The two cases deal with retained acreage clauses, which of course require the lessee to release acreage not assigned to a producing well at the end of the primary term or at the end of a continuous drilling program conducted after the expiration of the lease's primary term. In both of these lawsuits, the underlying leases made reference to proration units as the measure of the acreage that would be retained by the operator. A proration unit is a term of art employed to quantify the portion of a mineral reservoir that can be sufficiently drained by just one well. The rub here is that the Texas Railroad Commission has promulgated field rules which specify the permitted size of proration units. But, at the same time, operators submit their own maps with the regulatory agency, articulating the location and size of proration units that are ostensibly in line with the Commission's field rules. The question then becomes, what happens when the retained acreage clause is keyed off of a proration unit, but the unit defined in the field rules is different than the proration unit described in the operator's regulatory filings? The Seventh Court of Appeals in Amarillo in the XOG lawsuit reached the conclusion that the plain language of the underlying mineral lease permitted the contracting parties to use the more expansive acreage ceiling articulated in the Railroad Commission's field rules, even though Chesapeake had included a much smaller proration unit in its submissions to the Railroad Commission. By contrast, in the Endeavor matter, the Eastland Court of Appeals reached the opposite result, determining that the operator was bound by the smaller proration unit set forth in its filings with the Railroad Commission, as opposed to the more expansive boundaries permitted under the applicable field rules. As a result of these conflicting rulings from the appellate courts, the parties sought review from the Texas Supreme Court to resolve this apparent split in authority. Last week, however, the Texas Supreme Court declined to grant cert. Apparently, the language from the mineral leases in the two cases is sufficiently different in the opinion of the court to justify different results. Candidly, in my opinion, the Texas Supreme Court has put a remarkably fine point on the issue and has implicitly drawn a very nuanced hairline distinction, one which is likely to invite future litigation with potentially massive consequences. The takeaway from the Supreme Court's refusal to accept review is at least twofold. First, when drafting oil and gas leases incorporating retained acreage clauses based on proration units, you need to be painfully clear about whether it's your intention to be bound by regulatory field rules or by the operator's submissions to the Railroad Commission, since these are not necessarily one and the same. Second, if you are dealing with the preparation of an acreage release predicated on the size of proration units, you'll want to be careful to draft language in the release that protects you against the uncertainty surrounding this issue. My prediction is that we will see plenty of enterprising plaintiff-side lawyers seizing on this area of ambiguity as fodder for new strike suits that seek quick cash and sweetened lease terms. In a genuinely major development that could have massive repercussions for the oil and gas industry throughout the Lone Star State, the Texas Supreme Court recently heard oral arguments in late March in a case that challenged as ambiguous mineral conveyances that had been made on a county-wide basis. So here, for example, we're talking about a deed saying that I will sell you all of my right, title, and interest in all oil, gas, and other minerals in, say, Karnes County. Although the justices apparently did not ask many questions during oral arguments, their decision, to the extent they invalidate the deed with the all-encompassing countywide conveyance, could open the floodgates to a massive volume of mineral title disputes. Indeed, as one of the lawyers argued to the Texas Supreme Court, if blunderbuss mineral conveyances are invalidated as ambiguous, it would not be at all surprising to see a rush of landmen being dispatched to courthouses across the state who would pore over deed records to isolate just these kinds of conveyances and then try to obtain mineral leases from people who might have claims under the changed law. Naturally, this could wreak havoc on operators who have spent millions of dollars developing big plays, only to be confronted with the argument that their entire mineral leasehold is invalid. Needless to say, this is a case that should be closely watched, and in the interim, operators would be well advised to do a gut check to determine if any of their assets would be impacted by the wrong ruling from the Texas Supreme Court. In particular, if operators are poised to drill or otherwise devote large sums of money to operations on acreage that could be affected by an adverse decision, query whether you should put those operations on hold or, alternatively, seek protection leases from other parties who might have a live claim if the Texas Supreme Court determines that these kinds of conveyances are ambiguous and unenforceable. As always, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Finally, in news out of Colorado that could have implications for royalty class actions across the country, including in Texas, a federal magistrate there has granted a motion to certify a class in a large royalty payment dispute. The crux of the case is one that many of us are familiar with, and that is the deduction of post-production expenses from the mineral lessor's royalty payments. This is, of course, a huge cottage industry for plaintiffs' lawyers who represent landowners. I myself have extensive experience in the class action arena, having practiced for nearly a decade in a litigation boutique specializing in both the prosecution and defense of high-stakes, complex class actions. One of the most common and effective methods for diffusing class litigation is to attack the so-called commonality element of Rule 23 and its state law counterparts. In other words, you try to show that the individual circumstances of class members are so sufficiently disparate that class treatment would be ineffective because the parties would become mired in all of the varying factual scenarios presented by different plaintiffs. In class litigation over royalty payments, this tactic often sees defendants arguing that the underlying mineral leases signed by class members are not uniform, and therefore that class certification would be inferior to individual lawsuits. In the Colorado case, it was undisputed that the provisions in the leases held by class members were not the same. For example, some of the leases specifically address the allocation of expenses for post-production activities, whereas other of the leases are completely silent on the same issue. In my experience, this is a difference of some magnitude, and I would have expected the federal magistrate to focus more seriously on the issue. However, it would appear that the court dismissed this concern without extensive analysis. At first blush, this may seem somewhat insignificant, but if the decision stands, I expect that smart plaintiff-side class action lawyers will use this as a toehold, particularly in the oil and gas context, to effectively push back against arguments against class certification based on a lack of commonality. This is, of course, just another reason to use a mandatory arbitration clause coupled with a class action waiver in your mineral leases as a prophylactic against finding yourself stuck in a large class action with massive, even bet the company, levels of exposure. In my opinion, there is absolutely no excuse to leave this critical provision out of your lease forms.
Thank you for listening to Energy Law Roundup. If you would like additional information about anything from today's episode, you can contact Tom at 210-446-6999 or by email at tom@charlone.net. New episodes of this podcast are available every week on the web at www.energylawroundup.com, your one-stop source for breaking news and developments in energy law.